Welcome to WMUK.
Thanks for having me here, Erlene.
You have been in Kalamazoo for 12 years. What brought you to Kalamazoo?
Yes, I have been here for 12 years, and Stryker is what actually brought me here to Kalamazoo.
What kind of job were you doing when you were at Stryker?
So when I first came in, I was managing a line of production in the medical division. And so we were producing stretchers that you see all around. So everyone knows what Stryker produces in that sense. And so I did that. And then I moved into a role of a project manager. And my last role with Stryker was a senior project manager for mergers, acquisitions, and divestitures for the medical division.
How long were you at Stryker?
So I was at Stryker for 7 years, and I was still involved in a lot of social causes in that area there. So with diversity and inclusion, I work with our medical division in order to set some things up on a diversity and inclusion front, and was a vice president of the first group that we put together in reference to that. From a corporate standpoint, the very first corporate diversity and inclusion conference, I was on the team to put that together. And the second one, I actually led that team in organizing that for our executives within the organization. And Stryker has been responsive in really helping to create a culture where everyone feels to be a part. And so it was good to work with that and be able to be an advocate as we move forward. And now to see some of the things that have come out from that and where Stryker is going, it's just really amazing.
You have been the CEO of the Boys and Girls Club of Greater Kalamazoo since February, is that correct?
February 1st.
And you took over for Bobby Zell, who was there for a greatly long period of time. You have a connection to the Boys and Girls Club that starts at a very young age, and you've been involved with nonprofit work and things like that for a very long time, even before Stryker. So let's kind of go back in time. Where were you born? And let's talk about that connection to the Boys and Girls Club.
So I was born in Raleigh, North Carolina. And I joined my club the first day after my sixth birthday. So July 5th of 1972, I had wanted to join the year before, but I had to be 6 years old in order to join. And that was my birthday gift from my mom. It was $5 to join the club. That happens to also be the same year that Bob Izzell started working at the Boys and Girls Club here in Kalamazoo at our Lake Street unit. So it's just a coincidence component from that standpoint. But for me, the Boys and Girls Club, it was a place that not only saved my life, but it gave me life. And to give you a little more background on that, so my mom and biological dad separated when I was very young. I wouldn't know my dad if he walked through the door. I've seen him once since I was 6 years old and probably can only recall seeing him twice in my life. My mom was an alcoholic. She's a recovering alcoholic now, but my mom would leave me alone for weeks at a time. So as a 5, 6, 7 year old, I was walking the streets by myself. We lived in, at times, rooming houses where you would rent a room out of a house, and we didn't have a bathroom that we could use. So we'd have a bucket that I'd use a restroom in and another bucket that I would bathe in. And, you know, I'd have one pair of underwear that I would take off once a week and wash those once a week. I walked to my club. My club was about a mile and a half from my home. As a six-year-old, I'd walk there after school and walk home at 8 o'clock at night. And it was just a place. My club never knew a lot of these things that happened. But what they did know is that when I walked through the door, that I was a young man that they could have an opportunity to make an impact on. And they made a huge impact for me. One, they were the ones who followed up with my school to make sure that I was doing well in school. If I didn't go to school that day, our club had a policy that I could not be at the club, and I wanted to be at the club because it was a safe place for me. It was a place that I felt that I belong. I felt connected. The staff serve, one in particular, his name is Ron Williams. He served as not only a staff member, but as a friend, as a brother, you know, as a father. He was everything in so many different ways. And that's what the club really represented. They gave me leadership opportunities. They took me on travel trips with sporting teams or gave me opportunities to just get engaged and learn how to be a leader, how to give back. We did a lot of community things. So we'd go work with rest homes and things of that nature. They were there. I played in over 2,000 sporting events between 6 years old and graduating high school, and my club attended most of those. My family, my biological family, attended less than five of those in that time frame. So when there was something that was significant in my life, it was the club was a part of that transition for me.
Did you have any siblings at the time?
I was an only child. When I was 16, due to the environment that I had been in, I was in school and actually had sort of broke down and started crying with my Spanish teacher, who I was a teacher assistant for. And she got me connected with a counselor, high school counselor, and I had told them both some of the different things that were happening in my life. And it happened to be they got me connected with Child Protective Services, and the person that I was connected with had been a program director for the Boys Club at the time, because when I first joined, it was a Boys Club, and it later became Boys and Girls Club. And so James and I had a relationship already. So when I turned 16, James came and picked me up one day and took me to a runaway shelter as we worked with my mom to get me so that I could live in a program called independent living. So I lived in an independent living program for the last 2 years of high school, where I worked part-time for 20 hours a week, went to my boys club, did leadership components there, and was involved in student government and played varsity soccer in high school, and just lived a so-called normal life for me at that time. But that was a transition point.
Well, first of all, thank you for sharing that story and being that transparent and open with your life. Surely, I have to believe that touches some people and gets people to understand the true impact that the Boys and Girls Club can make in a young person's life. I've often heard it said that just one caring adult can really make a huge difference in a young person's life. As you were talking, I'm trying to imagine this, that when you were 5 years old, if you could just at least answer this question, if your mother was gone for weeks, how did you eat?
That's a great question. And sometimes I didn't. You know, there were times we at that time had what we called the welfare trucks that would come in, and they would, you know, come and everyone runs out there and they'd get their cheese and crackers and whatever. I sometimes would have a ketchup sandwich and that would be my meal for the day, or a banana sandwich or a syrup sandwich.
At the time, did they serve lunch at school?
They did serve lunch at school, but when school wasn't open, so on weekends, during the summertime. There were times when one of the staff members, Ron Williams, go back to him. And I'd also say that the executive director when I joined, Ralph Capps, is still the executive director of the club today. So as a matter of fact, I talked to him before agreeing to take on this position that I'm in now. And so I can pick up the phone and talk to him, or Becky, who's the administrative assistant there, that was there when I was 11. But, Ron, you know, he would take me and he would get me food. The club did not provide food at that time. It was just different things. But you just do what you need to do in order to survive.
You would go on to win your club's Youth of the Year competition.
Yes. So every club has a Youth of the Year, and then you go and compete on a state level and a regional level and a national level. And I was my club's Youth of the Year twice. I also happened to get my two younger cousins involved in the club after their biological parents passed away when they were 2 and 5, respectively. My grandparents became their legal guardians, and then my grandparents passed away when they were teenagers. And so both of them were like brothers to me, or are like brothers to me. And so we got them connected. One went on to win the National Youth of the Year, and he works in business on the East Coast. The other went on to win a Regional Youth of the Year award winner. And he is a physical therapist. He has his doctorate in physical therapy. And it is the club. So when I say that not only saved my life, but gave me life, it did that for my whole family. So you see that starts to spread when we can impact one young person and we get another young person and we're able to make that positive piece, and then to pay it forward. It's a part of our lifeline in my family.
Let's talk about paying it forward. We were talking offline about that. So fill in the gaps between after you graduated from high school to coming to Kalamazoo in terms of paying it forward.
So one thing to mention is that when I graduated from high school, one of the board members who had only met me once gave me scholarship funds that assisted me in going to college. So anytime I needed anything while I was in college, they were there to be able to support and protect me. In college, I
started. That's amazing.
It is amazing. It is amazing. In just one piece, I didn't meet him again until 2006 when I was inducted into my Boys and Girls Club's Hall of Fame back in Raleigh, North Carolina. He was there as well. And so just to get to thank him and say, this is, you know, the things that I'm able to do, you know, are what you provided. Because when I was 11 years old, you know, I thought of taking my own life. It was a year my family had
moved. Did you say when you were 11?
When I was 11. Yeah. My family had moved from the city into the country for a year, and my mom and her new husband were gone, and I wouldn't see them for weeks at a time. And we lived in a an old farmhouse. It had an outhouse. It had some indoor water, but it didn't really work much. And I had been there for weeks at a time by myself. And I thought, I don't want to do this anymore. And but I don't like pain. And my faith is the corner of who I am. And I took a knife. I stuck it to my stomach. And I said, I don't want to go through the pain. And it may not work. And so I stopped. But that was because my club wasn't there. It wasn't that safe place that I could go to every day. It wasn't the people that cared and checked in on me to make sure that I had this connection moving forward. Those are the things that a club provides. And sometimes you don't recognize that until it's too late or until you don't have it. So I'm thankful that I was able to recognize that. But going forward in college, as I said, I started a Big Brother, Big Sister organization when I was on college campus. I was a resident advisor. I graduated from college and I started and I was an officer in the Air Force. And
what was your major in college?
So I have an undergrad in business with a focus in finance. And then I have a master's in human resource development.
Okay, you were talking about you were with the ROTC?
So our Air Force ROTC. So I joined ROTC my last 2 years of college and then got my commission into the Air Force and was stationed in a little town called Knobnoster, Missouri. And there, a few miles down the road was an orphanage, and I went and started doing some volunteer work there. While stationed there, I became the executive officer for the base commander. Base commander oversees everything that happens on an installation, and before he basically approves things, it comes across my desk to review to make sure everything's in order for him to make that decision on. And the Department of Human Services was in need of foster families at that time, and they wanted to create a partnership with the Air Force installation there, our Whiteman Air Force Base. And it came across my desk. I saw it. I jumped up from my desk. I went into my boss's office and I said, sir, I need you to sign this and sign it now, and I'm going to be the very first volunteer. And he did, and I was. I was 27 years old, and my first foster son was 16 years old. And then I had another son that came to live with me. I worked as the youth director for a local church, a Methodist church that I went to, and high school youth. And one of my members, his family was moving outside of his school district, and he wanted to finish his senior year in the school district. And so he came to live with me, and he was 17 years old. His parents never met me until his day of graduation. I talked to his mom on the phone, and she said, yes, he can come and live with you if we would love to have that. But that just tells you about some of the need that we have. There was no Boys and Girls Club that was in that area. There was no safe place that young people could go to be able to get the guidance that I was blessed to have in my club back in Raleigh, North Carolina.
It sounds like there, you know, I'm listening to you talking about your major being business and finance, yet there's this other kind of human services, social services aspect to you. There was kind of always this like dual tension going on in your life. At the time that you were in college, what did you imagine your career to be?
It was
what did you hoped to be?
Well, there's always been that tug. I always wanted to. There is an incident that also happened when I was 11 years old, where I hadn't seen my mom in a while. And this time we had moved back into town, and I was working as a youth worker for my local Boys and Girls Club. And I got a check. I'm like, ooh, I got my first check. And it was like $14. But I don't have ID. I can't get it cash. I have to give it to my mom. And when I finally saw my mom, she came in. She was very intoxicated. She dropped her pants. She used the restroom. She put on some jeans she had bought for me. I only had two pair of jeans. And then I told her about the check. She took the check, and she's like, "No, you're not getting this money. This is mine. You need to help pay bills." And I walked out of the house, and I go, "I hate my mom." And it was in the same voice, "I don't hate my mom. I hate what the alcohol is doing to my mom." And so for me at that time, it was there was something greater than me that was guiding me. And for me, that's God. But that was the time that I made the decision that I wanted to help as many. At the time, it was really to adopt as many kids as I could feasibly afford. And feasibly is a matter of definition and interpretation. But that was a time when I wanted to make a difference in that.
Age was that again?
So that was 11.
That's what I thought I heard.
Yes. Yes. So that's always been the driver, because we rarely had electricity, but when we did, and in that time, you had National Geographic on TV all the time. So whenever I thought my life was really bad and I could get to a TV, I would look at National Geographic, and then I'd see young people walking around the streets with no clothes on or no food. Their stomach is so swollen because they can't go any further. And I'm like, I'm not that bad. I still have an opportunity, and there are people and resources that are available for me. I just have to figure out how to get connected and leverage those. But that was a motivation, and so it's always been that way to try to give back, because there's so many people that have given to me, and I can't do anything by myself. I've never been able to do anything by myself.
But when you ever envisioned an actual career, what did you think that you were going to be?
So I wanted to be, my first desire was to be a high school counselor or work on a college campus. I wanted to work with, 18 to 25 is really where the heart of my passion comes in. I just didn't at the time feel that I could do that in support my family and myself in the things that I would want to do in life. And so one of my other passions is to give back to my country, because it's the difference when I talk about National Geographic is that we have this great country that we live in that gives someone who is in poverty like myself still the opportunity to change that and make a difference. And so, and my grandfather, whom was one of my best friends, I love dearly. He served 4 years as a Marine and another 26 in the Army, and have a strong family history of military support. And so that was another passion for me. So I said, I'll go and I'll do the military. My plan was to retire after 20 years in the military, and then I could go and work on a college campus or in as a high school counselor, and not really focus on how much I'm making, but what the impact I'm being able to have. And that was the initial plan.
Okay, so you were looking at that career choice as a practical matter to support yourself, but meanwhile still be a foster parent and do all these other things to really help kids. So unless I'm missing something, somewhere along the way, you decide, you get yourself here to Kalamazoo, you begin to work at Stryker. Then the position opens up at Cedar Scholars at Western Michigan University. And I don't know if there was a job in between Stryker and Western. That's a program at Western Michigan University that helps former foster children transition into the college environment. How did you get connected with the Cedar Scholars program?
When I got here to Kalamazoo, so one of the things, no matter where I've been or what company I've worked for, I've always tried to find a way to be connected to helping young people. And so a big piece of that has been, as a foster parent, I've fostered over 20 young people, and I've adopted three that have experienced foster care, and I have 10 plus kids through various means, and none are biological. When I got here and I was working with Stryker, and friends found out my passion and sort of my background and my history, and actually the godfather of two of my two youngest kids came to me and said, Western is starting this program called CETA Scholars, and Dr. Yvonne Unruh is the person, and here's her number to connect with. I was offering my services, but as you're trying to do a startup, you're trying to say who really wants to be a part of it and what is it that we're trying to do here. But after a while, you know, Yvonne and I made a connection, and I became their very first mentor of the CETA Scholars program, of a young man whom I eventually did an adult adoption with just over a year ago. And so as the mentor and getting involved in the program, when the opportunity came and the CETA Scholars program decided that they were looking for a new director, I had looked back and took some time out to do a reflection and said, going back to that piece, I want to work on a college campus impacting 18 to 25-year-olds, or work in a high school environment as a counselor. And I had gone on and done all these other things, and each time I get further and further away from what my passion is. I've even switched jobs so that I wouldn't get too caught up in some of the financial rewards that you get in corporate, in the corporate world. So I said, it's for family. We looked at things and said, this is a good time, and we are set, and we can make this happen and not have a negative impact on what we are and who we are and what we can do. And so it was incredible support from family and incredible support from the university, and made that transition. And it was great. It is great. What I found in that, I believe, but I hadn't always applied, is that do what you're passionate in. It's not, and don't worry about the other pieces. If you are doing what you're passionate in and you're doing it well, then other things, you know, will happen. And such as getting the chance to come back and to be the chief executive officer for Boys and Girls Clubs of Greater Kalamazoo. It wasn't something I was pursuing. It was just something that came and they pursued me. But it was because I was able to do something that I was passionate in, hopefully do that fairly well, and they found that it can add value to this other opportunity.
And how many years were you at CETA Scholars?
I was the director of the CETA Scholars program for 5 years.
Okay. So what people do need to know is that before you got to the Boys and Girls Club, you used to serve on the board, and you had a number of positions on the board. You were the secretary, vice president, president. You've done a lot.
And I was serving in the role of past president. The one of the charming components is that when my predecessor, Bob Ezell, was making the decision, and when I of whether when he was going to retire, I had come into the president role, and I said, Bob, I've been on the board for many years, and I've heard that you're retiring in 5 years. I said, but every year it's 5 years, and I said, that's fine. If you're ready to retire, great. If you're not ready to retire, great. But if you are planning to do that within that time period, we need to make a plan. And so Bob and I began discussions at that time, and he said, yes, it's definitely going to be within 5 years. And then several months later, he came and he gave me a date, and I said, I'm going to communicate it. And I said, we're going to put a search team together. We want to make sure you're comfortable and ready. And he goes, yep, move forward, Chris. And I put the search committee together. People had asked me at that time if it was something that I was going to apply for. And I said, no, because I felt I was enjoying my role as the director of the CETA Scholars Program, and I didn't feel the work for what I wanted to accomplish in that role, that I had met all of those components for probably the most underserved youth, not just here in the Kalamazoo area, but in America as a whole. And we were just beginning to make some impact on a national and local level. So they continued to proceed. Presidency switched over. I moved into past president. We had 118 applicants. Got down near the end there to the final one, and the board president and the previous CEO came and sat down with me and said, "Hey, so what would it take for you to consider being in this position?" And that was a question I had never processed. And for me, that means I needed to take time out and just to, one, turn it over to God and do some prayer about that. And then I have some accountability partners to process that with. I talk with my boss here at Western and talk with the provost through the president, and just, you know, it was really, really a tough decision, because to me, it's not that one is better than the other, and they both have a high, high need. It was, at the end of the day, it comes to, where is God leading me, and what does he want me to do? And I felt that that's being the CEO for the Boys and Girls Club is where he was really leading me and pulling me to be and what was needed. And I'm like, how can you not do that, to give back to an organization that has given so much and continues to give so much to me and to my family, to be able to come back and to have an impact on the legacy of this going forward and to impact other young people such as myself? That is like having the biggest piece of chocolate cake and just being able to eat it. It's a win-win-win all around.
It sounds like you're really in your sweet spot. Moving forward, what are some of your goals at the Boys and Girls Club?
So one of the things that we are doing is figuring out what our strategic plan is. So the good piece is that our strategic plan ended in 2016, and the board and I are in the process of cultivating one that takes us not just through a three-year time frame, but we're looking through the 2024-25 fiscal year. And we are in the process of doing that, but there are a couple things that we're looking at. One is we want to strengthen the organization, and what that means is it's financial sustainability. It is leveraging our community partners. We're not trying to duplicate what's out there. We're trying to say, what's out there? How do we leverage it? When you look at the cycle of our youth, and so that means how our youth transition into our club, what value are we adding to them while they're at the club, and then how do we transition them out into the next phase of what they are going to be or who they're going to be? We need to look at all of those pieces, and then who do we have as partners that do this well? And how do we bring us together in order to have the most healthy impact? So we want to leverage that with our community resources. We want to enhance our staff retention and development. So in the nonprofit world, especially here, you're looking, it's not about pay. People do this because they have a joy and passion, but we still need to look at how do we do a respectable pay and how do we develop our employees and grow them and move things forward. We want to also look at how do we advocate for youth development, and then how do we reach more youth. We have a teen center in our club, but we don't have space big enough to impact all of the youth that want to be able to come. So as much as we're able to do, there's still more that is needed. When we look in our community, we have a very large Latino community. And right now, we're not able to impact them in the way that we would like to. So we want to build and strengthen that relationship and be able to reach those young people to help them develop. We have a very large refugee community that's in the area. Our club is in the three most underrepresented places in Kalamazoo. And so we want to make sure that we're impacting the young people that are there, and it in turn impacts their family. And how do we move that forward? And then we want to improve program quality. So we're always looking at every opportunity of engagement with the youth is a chance for an educational development moment. And so how do we do that, and how do we bridge that?
Do you have a time frame to try to develop a plan in each of those areas? Clearly, 2025 is far off, but is there a time that you're working with in your head?
Yes. So we've started that process. We'll finalize it by the end of our fiscal year, which is August 31st. And we've got specific objectives in each category that we look to do, from youth development all the way up through sustainability. And so we've got each of those things planned out for each year, and we'll actively look at that.
I can't recall if you mentioned as part of that one of your goals is infrastructure. Did you mention that?
So infrastructure is a big piece of our goal. Yes.
Are you thinking building elsewhere, building an additional facility, or just redoing the one that you have? Because you talked about not having enough teen space.
So it's looking at all of those different options and, you know, exploring all of those different components. One of the things, if you think about it, it's...
And for those who don't know, your main headquarters is at Edison Elementary School.
It's at the Lake Street unit. So
yeah, yes.
So we have a separate building from the school, but it connects,
right,
and we're
exactly
on the school's
property. We are on
property.
Their property, mm-hmm, there, right.
And KPS is an amazing partner to, mm-hmm, to have, because we all have the same goal. But the piece that we need to look at is what I try to explain to people. It's, you see this old house that you want to buy and purchase, and it has great bones, and we just need to go in and spruce it up some, but not just get it to 2017, but we need to get it to where are we going in the future, and getting it to the 2024-25 realm. So we have some infrastructure components that we're looking at, whether it's security of the building, whether it's how many youth do we need to serve, and do we have the capacity to serve them in the facilities that we do, what things are happening in the facilities, and how we do that based on the objectives that we're trying to, based on the impact that we're trying to have. We have a camp area that is in Hastings, Michigan. It's 200 acres. And so out there, what can we do to enhance the youth experience, and how does that go into developing those life skills and adding value to who they are as individuals? But when we're not using that, how do we leverage that facility to become self-sustaining from a revenue generation component, or to be able to add revenue back into the organization by supporting other programs that are impacting people? So we're just looking at that big picture and seeing what can we do, how do we do it, and then how do we do it with the partnerships that we have.
In terms of income, or I should say funding and income for some of these capital improvement projects and potential new programs, I don't know what you might come up with. Are you looking at different ways of doing funding? I know you talked about that this Hastings facility can bring in some income. Are you looking at a capital campaign, or?
So we're just processing all of those components, and that's a part of that strategic planning process, and saying, you know, well, how do we go from point A to point B? Some of it may be looking at what we're doing in streamlining or making it more efficient in what we're doing. Others are, how do we leverage the resources that we have? You know, there's some other resources we can go after. So we don't really have a lot of federal resources that we receive right now that we've intentionally not done. But how do we partner and leverage that? You know, when we look at partnerships with, say, Western Michigan University or Kalamazoo Valley Community College or K College, are there some partnerships that we can do that can come in and help with some of the programming components that we're looking at? So with the young people that we support, there's a lot of mental health support that's needed, and we don't have a direct connection. So can we go to an institution and, with what they're doing, leverage a way that we can get that type of support to be able to add value to our young people
without it really being part of your budget?
Without it really being part of our budget. So we're looking at what can we do within our own budget.
Being creative.
And what can we do from corporate sponsorships? What can we do from endowments? You know, when you look at over the One of the first things I did is I said, hey, what organizations have financially supported us, major organizations have financially supported us from a grant or a foundation standpoint over the past 5 years? And we had over 40, we had 45 institutions that had. And so that's a huge number. And so how do we leverage that and build that? Or are there other areas that we haven't reached out to? We have a lot of national partnerships, but we haven't necessarily leveraged those partnerships that are on a national standpoint at a local level.
One thing I've always been curious about, Boys and Girls Club National, it's national. But does your headquarters, so to speak, your national, do they provide funding to the local Boys and Girls Clubs, or are they all independently funded?
So the clubs are independently funded, but the national organization creates partnerships that allow, and so they are able to be a fiduciary to serve and provide funding for us. So we do get a juvenile justice program funding. It comes into the national organization, and then those funds are distributed to the local organizations based on the youth that you're serving and things of that nature. So that's a small component.
And you mentioned an endowment. Does the local Boys and Girls Club have an endowment, or is that something you're looking to explore?
So we do have an endowment, but I would like to grow that substantially. The piece of paying it forward, I take that, very seriously. It's just like you as an individual, when you are working and you want to go to an organization that has some type of retirement benefit plan. And so you're going to take some of your money that you're getting in and invest off the top into your future so that you have a future. And, the way that I see it is that if we can grow that endowment, then we can focus more on the programming and the quality of programming that we're providing versus the need to have to go out and to garner funding to support the program.
And finally, as we close out here, I can't recall if you mentioned this, but I thought also that a priority that you have too is incorporating kind of more of a youth voice in the programming.
Youth voice is a critical component. I think it's very difficult for us. When I say us, I mean me, the staff, our board, our community, to talk or support something that we are no longer a part of. Now, I have been a youth. We all have been a youth. I have been a youth in the Boys and Girls Club. But the things that I went through as a young person, I was molested by 13 different people, some on multiple occasions. During my time between 6 and 16 years of age, my club didn't know that. But they were there to support me and give me a safe place to go. When you spend that time with a young person, you don't have to know exactly what they're going through. But when you spend that time and you give them hope and you just show them that you care, that is huge. And you learn a lot of different things. This past year when we did our annual meeting, one of our board members presented on the plight of the young people that come into our club. And she had done... she had done some research on this piece with some young people, and she said, "So when you're coming and you're trying to get to, I think in that case it was to the school, what are the things that you have to go through?" And they painted this, they did this drawing of all these pictures and things of that nature, and it was shooting, it was gang violence, it's the texting, the bullying, all of these different components. It's the way that those things are done. It's so much more intense these days. And she's like, "Where's the positivity that is here?" And it was in these little spots. And so it's more difficult for them to be able to see that light at the end of the tunnel. We need to be able to understand what those young people are going through and how they're experiencing it today, because it's the way that they're receiving that, even though it's a similar component, is very different than how I was able to receive that as a young person, so that we can go out and be their advocates, that we are the ones that can go and impact the policy, that we are the ones that can go and to provide the protection that they need. We are the ones that can ask the questions that they don't know. But if we don't understand what it is that they have or what it is that they're going through, then it's harder for us to be the advocates and provide them the space that's going to help them to change the paradigm from which they've come.
Chris Harris Wimsett, that is a powerful story. I wish you a lot of luck at the Boys and Girls Club. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much, Arlene.